Well, we're really fortunate today to have John Kapik with us. Coming from the East Coast, and John does as well, I've always been impressed at this kind of close-knit cardiovascular community, and such stability. When I see folks here that I know have been in this industry for a real long time, it has such staying power. And yet, this is a segment that has been surprisingly volatile for the last 4 years, to say the least. Not the least of which has been the emergence of Abbott as a major cardiovascular player. I was struggling there because I don't really want to say the demise of Guidant. Let me say the transformation of Guidant and its new role in Abbott's cardiovascular business. And certainly one person has been central to that whole development, that whole phenomenon, and that's John. So John, we're delighted to have you with us. And let me just begin. Your interest in and your kind of dedication to the device industry actually goes back very far. You were born on the East Coast, and you told me once that really you first got the bug about medical devices in high school. Tell us how that came about.
Well, and actually, it's hard to believe that it was so many years from high school, and I won't disclose how many years that's been. But I went to high school in a very small school in upstate New York, and had the opportunity when the guidance counselor said, well, you're pretty good in math and science. You ought to go and review. Some of you are of my age, there were books you could look at in the guidance counselor's office. And one of the areas was medical technology, and the product that was described, or at least the research area that was described, was the development of an implantable and total artificial heart. And I remember leaving that day from the guidance counselor's office and said, well, not only was that way cool, but looked like a very interesting thing to do. So my first search then started in the area of medical technology, and in particular searching for schools that had biomedical engineering.
In college, you were in a joint program both at medical school and engineering school. What tipped you over and made you become work in the industry side rather than in the why did you not become a physician?
Yeah, well, I ended up going to RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic in upstate New York, and looked at Case Western, looked at MIT, and what I at least initially draw my interest to RPI was they had a joint program with Albany Medical Center. It was a fairly aggressive program. You start on the RPI side. It was a six-year program. You go all the way through summer. And you're pre-accepted into med school, provided your grades hit a certain level. And I'd say about 2 years into the program, I remember my advisor telling me that he saw me much more as an engineer than a physician, only because as he would ask me questions or we would challenge each other, I would always draw boxes. And he says, your physicians don't draw boxes. They, and not to say anything against physicians, they recite from memory or from their feeling, and I was always drawing a box with inputs and outputs, and at that point he pushed me, and I think gladly accepted the move into more of an engineering discipline. So I always stayed connected to biomedical engineering, always took my medical courses at Albany Med because we could cross-enroll, but from that point forward saw myself much more as an engineer than a physician.
Now, did you think at some point that you'd have a career more in academia or more in research than in business per se? I know you added an MBA to your graduate studies, but talk about that evolution for you personally from a joint med school engineering program to an engineering and then ultimately to the business side of the industry.
But I started in biomedical engineering. My undergrad was in biomed, and then transitioned into a master's in biomed, working in the area of cardiovascular research. At that point, I moved over into the electrical engineering department and got my master's in EE, because what I was becoming more and more interested in was what I would generally call computer applications in medicine, but how one could apply more traditional engineering in electrical sciences, particularly in signal processing, which was what I was doing in electrical engineering in satellites, and how you could actually be picking signals out of noise. So I started in the biomed to the electrical engineering, and then got very interested in a project in respiratory gas analysis and how you could estimate cardiac output from analyzing gas exchange. To get to your question, through that, I started working in the cardiovascular research lab and doing some contract research with a number of medical device companies, mostly in the area of cardiac output and cardiopulmonary monitoring. Which actually connected to me to Lilly in an indirect way. But I became very interested in how the contract research people made decisions about which projects would go forward and which ones wouldn't. And although I'm not wearing a suit today, I would always comment to my advisor that we would go for a project of several months only to have a quarterly visit from someone in a suit who would ask a question which was totally outside of what I thought was relevant for the project, which was the market value or the intellectual property or something outside of the question, which I thought was the most important, is it going to work? And it was more of the question of, could you make money doing it? Did it have a competitive advantage? And what was the way in which this would come to market? And so I started to take courses in the evening at the business school, which RPI does have, the Lally School. And through the course of not really intending to get an MBA, got one just by virtue of being able to take enough courses. And that kind of concluded with my PhD and my MBA at the same time.
So at some point you connected with a man named Al Potvin at Lilly. Who was Al Potvin and how did he kind of initiate your career in this industry?
Al was the person at Lilly at the time who was running the research within the medical device division. And Al was also the chairperson for the Biomedical Engineering Society. And I was functioning as the student editor or student contributing editor to the magazine. And so Al and I had a relationship through the BME group of the IEEE area. And Al asked me, as he knew I was interested in business and I was graduating with what he thought was an interesting combination, asked me whether I'd be interested in interviewing at Lilly in a group in the medical device division, which was really doing technology assessment and involved with the mergers and or acquisitions that were occurring in the MDD group.
Was that drawing more on your MBA work or more on your PhD work? Were you more applying the things you had learned as an engineer and as a biomedical engineer, or more, was it more business oriented?
If I think of the structure of the group, it's hard to separate the role. Although I would say my job was technology assessment in the group in Indianapolis at the time. There were several physicians. We had several people who were predominantly with business degrees. We also had some legal counsel. And my role was much more technology assessment. Although I think as I came to appreciate over time, it's hard to separate things when you model the potential of an acquisition. The technical risk, legal risk, market risk, or clinical risk are sometimes intertwined to a level where it's hard to characterize them as one or the other. And that really was the role that I played, was more to answer from an engineering standpoint the question of, from an engineering standpoint, can this work?
What was the first project that you worked on that resulted in a major either acquisition or technology development project at Lilly?
Well, the largest and probably most complete was the DVI acquisition, which occurred in the sequence of acquisitions by Lilly after ACS and a number of other medical devices. And I guess, as you would say, typically needs to occur. Not only do you identify the target, but in that process, you have to assess the competitive landscape and the alternative. So, although we ended with DVI as the acquisition, we assessed laser angioplasty, other forms of rotational atherectomy, other forms of trying to address what at that time, which was now 88, 89. What was perceived to be the Achilles heel of balloon angioplasty, which was restenosis. And looking at alternatives to either remove plaque, push it aside, or in other ways deal with the regrowth was really the focus. And at the conclusion of that analysis, we made the decision to move forward to acquire DVI as part of the medical device
division. Were you in Indianapolis at that time?
Yes.
Give us a sense of who you were working with at that time, because Lilly has been such a prolific developer or producer of senior executives in this industry. Who were some of the folks that you were working with at Lilly at that time? I know Ron Donald was already on the West Coast at that point, yeah, but who were some of the folks you were working with?
Well, for a period of time, Ron was out in Ron Donald was out running ACS, and then later to a higher role once DVI was acquired to the vascular businesses out here. For a period of time, Ed Miller, who was coming predominantly from the pharma side, was my director Eventually, Ron Machicaria came in to run the organization from his role, which had been up at CPI running the cardiac pacemakers group. Ron came down and ran the MDD division, and so I worked for a period of time with Ron as well. Several other people who were in the group, you know, Brian Farley, who runs Venus Medical out here, and Jim Fitzsimmons, who's been to several startups, and I'm not sure what Jim is doing now, but is in the area still of medical technology, as well as several people who are in and out of different companies and in the industry.
So you worked in that planning group for 3 years. Any other major projects that you were working on during that time? I know at some point you'd make a transition to Lilly's CRM business. What were you working on? How did you make that transition?
Well, there were several projects we worked on, and some of which resulted in acquisitions in, and also decisions not to further pursue. So we had investments in Organogenesis. We had investments in Abiomed because we were interested in growing blood vessels, mm-hmm. which was an interesting thing and exciting thing to consider, but a very difficult thing to do. And in Abiomed, not only for ventricular assist, but also cardiac assist in a more intra-aortic fashion. And we worked ourselves out of those investments because they didn't seem to fit the profile of what we wanted. And also worked in the acquisition and licensing with ACS to things like the STAC perfusion catheter and what I would call more of technology in licensing in or intellectual property in. Over the course of time, we also worked in strategic planning in areas where we set up the early work and the early funding for what later became the left ventricular pacing from a right-sided approach, which, you know, over the course of several years transitioned into the biventricular pacing program. Some of that early research work was funded by and done in Indianapolis in Al's group, and then later transitioned up to CPI.
How opportunistic was it, or how planned was it? I mean, when you were looking at projects, would you basically consider anything? Was Lilly basically considering anything in the cardiovascular or maybe even beyond space at that time? Or did you really have a pretty focused sense of where Lilly wanted to build its cardiovascular business?
Well, I would say, you know, there always was, I think, the opportunity and the characteristics of businesses that were interesting. I'd have to say through those 3 years in Indianapolis, and it actually continued even after, we went through a fairly extensive exercise, and I was describing this earlier, actually. We called it COSMO, Clinically Oriented Search for Medical Opportunities. And with that, kind of took a more open book or broad approach to try to identify what were some interesting businesses to be in. And, you know, it's still my philosophical belief that you need to start with a clinical search, because if you have a technology that's interesting or you have a business that sounds interesting, unless it's chasing a big problem, at the end of the day, it won't result to as much as you might have wanted it to be when you went down that path. So our search started with big clinical problems where the demographics were going to drive them towards increasing over the course of time, and then particularly we searched for where at least in hospital, because we like the idea of working in hospital because it requires less investment in a sales force, but where there were long lengths of stay with wide standard deviations such that a more minimally invasive approach could bring either the standard deviation down or the mean in. And I think that fundamentally drove a lot of our investment in angioplasty to replace bypass surgery, left ventricular pacing through the right side to replace what had been a much more invasive approach towards dealing with heart failure, which led to several other investments kind of starting with that premise of a minimally invasive approach to a more extensive surgical procedure and operate in a manner to reduce lengths of stay, reduce complications, and tighten up the standard deviation and, of course, patient outcome.
Now, this was 20 years ago, but as you look back, Were there any opportunities that Lilly passed on at that time that, in retrospect, you said, gee, you know, that it would have made sense if we had continued to pursue that, we'd continue to make that investment?
Well, passing is a term of time, and so let me try to describe that in the following way.
That Not I that think hindsight isn't 2020.
I think there were several ideas that we looked at, which were not yet technologically feasible, but had all the characteristics of a problem that was big enough to have an impact if you solved it, and where the patient benefit was strong enough mm-hmm. to have an economically viable business. Because back then, if you will, and even to the point of today, we looked at fully bioabsorbable stents as a way to solve the problem of the acute recoil of angioplasty. So I would almost argue that it wasn't passed on at the time. I think the technology was not yet available to enable the solution. And I'm a believer that you don't pass it, you just park it. You park it at a point where you say all the fundamentals were there. Now, do we understand what technologically needs to happen to enable the solution? And then when you observe those technologies coming together, can you now revisit the concept or revisit the idea? Because if it clinically made sense and the patients were large enough in either their need or volume together, you may just be waiting for a technology to be enabled by what I would say might be a core electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, material science solution. And that, I think, is one of the areas of technology forecasting that probably is underappreciated, is being able to see the technologies come together, remember the potential solution, and connect it to a big problem. And if, as anyone who works in startup companies, if you can find that, you know, put your dollars there, and go after it.
We had Julio Palmas on this stage, and he talked early on in the development of the first coronary stent, of going to a lot of companies and basically getting no's from them. In fact, it was Ethicon through Johnson & Johnson, or Johnson & Johnson through Ethicon, that in-licensed the first technology. Did Guidant pass on the Palmas shot stent? And where did Guidant, because Guidant would eventually develop the most successful coronary stent program. How did the coronary stent program at Guidant develop? When did it get started, and how did it come into Guidant?
Yeah. Well, there was a considerable amount of work that was done, you know, within the early days of ACS on metallic stents. I think it's very difficult sometimes to play it in retrospect without trying to characterize what was occurring at the moment. And, you know, at the moment, most companies were looking at metallic or scaffolding to deal with the acute issues of balloon angioplasty. We had in the marketplace the Bork-Shiley valve situation, which was evolving, where, you know, I think everyone was appreciating that permanent structures can sometimes fail, and if they fail in a catastrophic manner, it can be catastrophic to the patient and the company at the same time. So I think there was a fairly strong bias towards solving what I think most people appreciated was a temporary problem with a permanent implant that has the potential of being a permanent risk for the patient over the course of time. And surely, as I'm sure Julio mentioned, it was not without its issues of acute thrombotic issues and all of the challenges of understanding the appropriate pharmacologic therapy. That being said, ACS was working not only on permanent stents, but bioabsorbable stents, and even at the early stage, drug-eluting bioabsorbable stents, without really knowing what the drug was or what the right treatment should be.
Was that project located out here in California, or were you working on that within the
planning
group?
It was a California-based project. Although, you know, as is always the case, pushing on the today technology and investing in the future technology, one can always revisit, was the right amount of dollars spent and in the right focus. But I do think the appreciation was there that there needed to be a better way than just balloon angioplasty.
So you've been identified, I think, to folks from the outside so much with the vascular business, which you did run, in fact. But in fact, you spent most of the 1990s in the CRM business at Lilly/Guidant. Mm-hmm. What did you do there, and did it feel as if you were going to a whole new area, or were you comfortable with the CRM? It is more consistent with your electrical engineering background.
Yeah. What I have to say, as an electrical engineer who worked in signal processing, going into the CRM, the cardiac rhythm management business, was very exciting, because there is so much that's embedded within trying to detect, is this truly VF, a hemodynamically significant VT, and of course then determine the appropriate therapy. So I went from the business planning group in Indianapolis to the director of new product planning in the cardiac rhythm management organization, which really worked with the engineers on the definition of and the specifications for new products, but was a kind of a bridging function between marketing and R&D. And I'd have to say, for me, it was a very exciting time because I could try to speak both languages, the language with the engineers of, can it work, will it work, and what are the technical issues, and then to the marketing group where, not necessarily being confused by the facts, marketing wanted everything, and new product planning had to arbitrate between what was possible, and although what might be possible would take forever to do, and how do one strike that. So new product planning was really my first role within the CRM organization.
And then you did marketing. And what were your other responsibilities at CRM?
Well, as I went from new product planning, I had the opportunity to become the VP of global marketing, which at the time we were launching the first programmable defibrillator. Some of you may recall in time that was the Ventac P, which before that time, units were not programmed. They were configured on the line with jumper wires. And for all those who can appreciate what that meant, it meant a patient with a certain rate had to be, if you will, built to order, or ordered to build for that particular patient. So we went to programmable Ventac P, which was still an abdominal implant, on patches, to the development of transvenous leads, to, of course, dual chamber pacers and dual chamber defibs, to then small pectoral implanted devices. So I was VP of marketing for 7 years and launched several generations pacers and defibs through that time.
Now, almost smack in the middle of your time at in Minneapolis, Lilly spun off Guidant into a separate company. What was the impact on you personally as in your role there? How do you think that move reverberated through the company? Was it good, or did you find yourself now as a newly public company and no longer a kind of protected division within a much larger pharma company? Did it make your job more challenging?
Well, if I go back in that time as a Lilly employee, Lilly employees were given the opportunity of either at the time of the creation of Guidant going back to Lilly, or to going with the entity which was being created, Guidant. And although I did work at Lilly and kind of carried a Lilly card, so to speak, I was never really on the pharma side of the business. So for me, it was an easy choice. It was what I loved doing in terms of technology and what I found very exciting in terms of a career. And the creation of Guidant was a very interesting time because although we were an IPO, I think it, as in many ways you consider, launching an IPO as giving birth, we were giving birth to a teenager. It was not a small company at the time we went public. And I think that was, for me, a very rewarding and very exciting time. I wouldn't necessarily call it, on disconnecting us from the security of Lilly. I think it was in the creation of Guidant, the very unique opportunity, I'd say you very rarely have, although I've had the chance to have it twice now, to think about how to create a company in a way in which when you structure it in the manner in which it can be successful. Mm-hmm. Several companies have the challenge of changing over time. We had somewhat the opportunity to decide with Guidant, given that we were separating from Lilly, what was the infrastructure we wanted? What was the organizational structure? How were we going to invest in intellectual property and or things like IT? And start from scratch, if you will. So it was a unique opportunity.
And as you say, it was not a classic IPO. It was $1 billion valuation. Did the way you approach business change now that suddenly there were direct shareholders and not indirect shareholders who were now looking for this $1 billion company to, and Guidant did phenomenally well over the course of its run, and particularly in the first several years. And the increase in stock price was incredible through the 1990s.
Yeah, I think there were philosophically certain things that were done that enabled some of that, but then also the transparency of what we were doing and into the stock price was an invigorating, sometimes challenging experience. And I think as the philosophy of employee ownership, as the philosophy of getting everyone aligned on certain key areas and principles, which were global product innovation, economic partnerships with customers, organizational excellence. Those were the three areas. And all of that, believing would drive shareholder value and creating employees as owners, not renters, if you will, of a career, I think was a philosophical belief, and we were able to do that, as most startup companies are able to do, with equity and a very connected program for our employees with the benefit of stock price appreciation.
As you said, you were there when they launched, when Guidant launched its first implantable defibrillator. This was also, frankly, the time of the stent wars and all of the kind of buildup about coronary stents, both bare metal and drug-eluting stents. What was it like working in the CRM business during the time of the stent wars? And give us a sense of where the CRM business fit within the overall Guidant portfolio at that time in terms of opportunity and driving growth and things like that.
Well, I think at that time, if you went back to 1994, 95, there really were two emerging technologies. One was the movement in the cardiac rhythm management business from abdominal implants to pectoral implants, and the movement from simple pacing technologies to dual chamber pacing, so a way with a heart failure patient to provide more benefit in synchronization. I think we had the opportunity in the creation of Guidant to be at a unique point. I think the stent was emerging from other companies first, but I think with a clear view that we had a winner in the multi-link family, and to be also participating in the fast expansion of, with technology also, of the cardiac rhythm management market. So very unique position to have leading edge products at both at a very important time in the company history. That surely had its challenges of trying to manage getting into both and being successful in both, but it did create a lot of momentum in the early days of Guidant.
In 1997, you left the United States. You went over to Germany and you ran Guidant's entire product line. Guidant's entire product line under your purview there?
In the creation of Guidant, I actually headed up a task force, which was globalization. And I think at the time we talked about what was important for us as a business and what was important for senior leaders is to have international experience. And having headed up the project, I just remember when Ron called and said, you remember that project you headed up? Now you need to go international, and Germany is the place to go. And we actually, at that point, Fred McCoy went over to run Japan, and I went over to run Germany, and I think it was really the belief that you had to have some knowledge of how the business worked in a place where you didn't speak the language, and I didn't speak German. So it was an opportunity, I'd say, for me personally, which I'm very appreciative of, to figure out how to lead a country or lead an organization with, at least initially, I'll say, where people could talk behind my back in front of me. But over time, I came smart enough in German to realize when that was happening and would provide some feedback. But I think in that regard, you're challenged in your management capability because it's just, foreign is too strong of a word perhaps, but it's different and you have to manage in a different way than when it's first intuition.
Did you enjoy it, or did you always see it as a temporary pause on your career? Because you would come back fairly soon to the United States.
Well, it wasn't a pause. I'd have to say it was probably, for my career, one of the most challenging positions that I had, and where I'd probably have to say developmentally I learned the most. And so it was also the opportunity, having been quote a CRM person, to go over and run the vascular business, the cardiac surgery business, the interventional cardiology business, and to understand more about how they all came together in a more commercial operation. So having been inside in R&D, inside in business planning, this was a very operational, deliver the numbers kind of a position in a very challenging market, as some of you who have interacted in the German marketplace know. The economics and the business is challenged oftentimes, particularly with high impact, which often means high cost, medical technologies, which need to work their way through the German healthcare system.
So you must have done very well, because in 2000, when Guidant reorganized and Ginger Graham went from running vascular to the office of the chairman, and Jay Graff, who'd been running CRM, also joined the office of the chairman, you came back to head up the vascular business, and Fred McCoy, whom you just mentioned, came to run CRM. Given that you had been in CRM through much of the 1990s, how is it that you got to vascular? Why didn't you take over the CRM business and Jay and Fred come back and run the vascular business?
It's interesting you ask, because I remember when Ron called me, I asked the same question. I think it was...
Did you have a choice, or was it presented to you as this or nothing?
I think you always have a choice to say no. you don't always have a choice to give the answer you want. But I'd have to say, in hindsight, one, I am passionate about the vascular business, so in retrospect, it was a great move for me. Personally, I also think that it was an opportunity and for me to run a California company. I don't know how to describe that other than and think about Guidant or any company. There are cultures within the culture, mm-hmm. and some of that is driven by the I'll say this in the way that the dress of your physicians. So at that time, electrophysiologists still wore three-piece suits, and cardiologists wore business casual, right? I think that fundamentally, if you think of interacting then as a company, you have to be like your customers in terms of how your processes are, how your structure is, and working in the cardiac rhythm management business is different than working in the vascular business because the customers are different and they respond differently. Some of that is also driven by, Midwest, West Coast. So, maybe there's very few West Coast CRM companies, and at least there are some Midwest interventional cardiology companies, but if you add them up, they're mostly California cardiology companies. And it's that way for probably some reasons we can get into, but I do think there are different dynamics in terms of company cultures that exist, being West Coast and Midwest. So
how much was there a feeling that the culture in vascular was the old ACS culture? I ask that because we're going to talk about the biovascular division in just a minute, but was it a California culture, or was it that old ACS startup interventional cardiology, we're creating a new kind of business here that you came to, as opposed to a CRM or even Germany, which was a pretty kind of solid, well-established, well-entrenched business?
Well, I'd have to say that the fields, although both very technologically complex and on the edge, they operate, at least at that time, with a different rhythm of the business, and not to play off CRM, but a different cycle time of product development and a different way in which product development occurs. And you asked about BVS, and I'll come back to this point. At that time, a lot of what was happening in interventional cardiology was the opportunity to iterate, not necessarily in the clinic, but iterate in the development phase and do that very quickly to continue to improve in test fixtures how products performed. And that's a very different cycle time thinking than when you've really got to get it right in a manner, and because the clinical pathway is long, the product development pathway is long. And I'd have to say in that regard, at that point, CRM and vascular were very different. You could, at that point, take a prototype very quickly from concept to something which you could evaluate in a preclinical and then even at that point into a clinical environment. That was not the timeline for cardiac rhythm management, and measured in months, but they were different. And I think that drives a lot to what the California organizational structure and dynamic environment is. And needless to say, and also to say that when you consider being a vascular business, it's extrusion, it's lasers, and it's machine shop, and there's probably no better place to combine those three things than here in the Bay Area. So that's where the core capabilities were.
What were the challenges? What were the dynamics of the vascular business when you got there in 2000? Just from an outsider's perspective, it seemed to me that two things characterized Guidant at the time. One was the remarkably deft success you had in sustaining leadership in the bare metal stent business. Overlay that with the early stumbles that you had in drug-eluting stents. What were you wrestling with both of those at that time, and what were the primary challenges and projects that you were working on during that time?
Well, I would characterize the history of and probably the capability that still exists in the organization to understand how to iterate sounds too soft of a word, but to innovate. The innovation that happened through several generations of stent design was not by accident. It was by design. And I think knowing how to logically move from, the multi-link to the duet, the TriStar, Tetra, Penta, Zeta, on division, that was a march, that happened. I think as we started to build our understanding not only of the need to be more aggressive in drug-eluting stents, but to build that capability, it required us to build different capabilities, analytical chemistry, pharmacology, probably a deeper understanding of vascular biology and how, you know, pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics actually work. This was a capability that within our legacy organization didn't exist and we had to build. And that is something which takes time, and over the course of time, as I believe today, we've built a world-class capability in these areas, I think evidenced by the product we are on the verge of having here in the U.S., but it does take time. Mm-hmm. So I think that probably is a category or an area where probably could have started earlier, could have started in a different way, but at the end of the day, it's something that, you know, the sooner you start, the more focused you start, and the more you understand the importance of having the right people in the organization, you know, that's probably a learning point through that whole experience.
Every company that I've worked with in the drug-eluting stent business has said privately that along the pathway there were more twists and turns and things that went right and things that went wrong than they ever could have planned for, particularly as device companies, and has a lot to do with the pharmacology. J&J, in fact, did not think they were going to be first with a drug-eluting stent, and they wound up being first. Anybody knows the pharmaceutical business knows that it's filled with things that go right and things that go wrong, and more things go wrong than go right. But as you look back, do you think that there were things that Guidant could have, should have done, not could have, but should have done differently, or was it really just the very nature of adding a pharmaceutical product to adding a pharmaceutical agent to a device that, you know, led to the early problems?
Well, I mean, that hindsight is always 20/20. I would say that, if you look at pharmaceutical product development and you look at how many compounds that are successful in phase one don't make it all the way to commercialization, it's not inconceivable to think that not all drug-eluting stents are going to work, right? You know, one could ask the question of, if the first one didn't, should you have been successful on the second or third? That's a legitimate question. But I think through each of those learning experiences, I think we came to appreciate why it didn't work and then how to understand, okay, if it didn't work for this reason, how could we apply that knowledge to when we took the next step within the DES world, how can we make that next step in a much more smart fashion or a way in which we've reduced some risk in that next step. And I'd have to say through all of that, we do have certain foundational principles we still adhere to, which is, although it is a drug-eluting stent, and that clearly is what the product is, it is a stent. And the stent is in the patient for the life of the patient, or at least until we have bioabsorbables. And therefore, you have to be on a strong foundation of the stent, because without that foundation, you're putting a DES coating on something that you're trying to fix, perhaps the problem of the stent with a DES coating. It would be even better to start with world-class stent and then build from there. And I think that principle is played out over time to be one we're very excited about having and one that, you know, we plan to build upon from here.
Well, that leads nicely into the whole area of the biovascular stent, because 3 years after taking over vascular, you went over to head up this new project. I know it's a project that was important not only for the technology, but for a kind of new business model within Guidant. Talk about how the bioabsorbable vascular division came about, where it came from. Was it through a relationship with Synacor? Was it with Dr. Stack directly? And why was it so different within the context of Guidant?
Yeah. Well, let me try to set the stage for what was occurring in 2003, which is when we created BVS as a an entity. We had been involved with Guidant at the time looking at a metallic stent with a bioabsorbable coating that was delivering everolimus, a program that didn't come to market, but where I think in that program we learned a tremendous amount about the ability to deliver a drug from a bioabsorbing material, even though on a mechanical or a permanent backbone. I think, at least as I approach that, and as Richard Stack, as some of you may know, has long been a proponent, believer, and probably as an individual, never gave up on the idea of a bioabsorbable or even bioabsorbable drug-eluting stent, it really clicked that, in essence, what that program demonstrated is we were I won't say half the way there, but we were a considerable part of the way there towards realizing where many of us, and myself included, first got connected to stenting, which was it was a problem of balloon angioplasty to have abrupt recoil, vascular dissections, which needed to be tacked so that they didn't create an acute issue for the patient, where there was elastic recoil, and where, you know, oftentimes it was the crossing your fingers for the first 24 to 72 hours and hoping the patient could get out. So those were temporary problems, at least at that time, of balloon angioplasty. We went to a permanent implant because 316L was a material that all companies could work into something which allowed it to be predictably deployed and have appropriate radial strength. So we ended up with a permanent implant. The reason I mention that is I think when we saw the coming together that you could actually deliver drug from a bioabsorbable material, there was only one remaining problem to solve. Now, not that it was easy, is how do you make the stent out of the same material that we've already demonstrated could be bioabsorbed into the patient in as a coating? So I guess my belief at that point was that was a singular problem to solve. And I, you know, from a product development standpoint, you're always trying to manage risk. We didn't need to identify a drug. We didn't need to identify the dose and release rate. We didn't need to identify the material that could be bioabsorbed safely. We just had to figure out how to make a stent out of that material. And although that is not an easy thing to do, it at least is one thing. And with that, we said, well, we should create a company to focus on this. Now, a few years earlier, we had actually worked with Synacor to provide some in funding to actually have that idea incubated within Synacor. And the reason we did that is because, like any company, we were focused on a full, a permanent drug-eluting stent and didn't have the bandwidth as a company to do it internally. So we funded this work and sponsored this work in Synacor. In March 2003, we essentially created BVS with the technology acquired in from Synacor, having incubated it in that fashion, and created the structure that became BVS over time.
But it wasn't just an interesting, innovative technology. It was an innovative business model for Guidant. You once said to me that one of the reasons we took BVS out of Guidant was that Guidant was too slow to move. And that's always true of companies where you're working on technology that requires you to walk away from a core business that you're very heavily invested in. What was it like, however, running a business that was the BVS business seen as a natural adjunct or follow-on to the core stent business, or was it seen as a challenge to the business that Guidant had at that time?
Well, the way I would characterize that is in the following way. If a fully bioabsorbable drug-eluting stent were able to work as well as a permanent drug-eluting stent, it would totally replace permanent drug-eluting stents. And in any company, if your whole business is permanent drug-eluting stents, it's hard sometimes to invest aggressively in a disruptive technology which, by virtue of its disruption, disrupt your own company. There is always a tendency to have 1,001 reasons why it won't work, because if it does, it's going to turn everything upside down. And I think in that construct, sometimes companies can't get the focus or can't get the attention to some of these programs. So I would say a fully bioabsorbable drug-eluting stent is very disruptive, and it was our belief that if it's going to be disruptive, we should disrupt ourselves as opposed to have it disrupt us from an entity we're not connected to. The challenge at the moment was with so much attention, focus, rightfully so, on permanent drug-eluting stents, how could you actually do both things in the same company? So we created BVS with a construct of very different, perhaps, in a spin-out or startup where guidance ownership was 51%, which was a requirement for certain intellectual property, but where the 49% that wasn't guidance was participation with Synacor and outside investors. So it was what I'd consider to be a hybrid structure. And in that creation, I left Guidant, while still technically in Guidant with that 51% ownership, to report to the board and to search for a place to put BVS. We put BVS in Mountain View for reasons of, one, it was a great location, and as I would describe it, it was close enough yet far enough to, you know, where the organization was so that we could have the benefit of being able to access technology, access capability, but far enough where we were able to not have a business interrupted in our singular focus with the things which oftentimes in a big company can take time.
From a business model perspective, looking back, do you think it was a success? Do you think spinning that out as a separate business was a success, or could you have done the same thing within the context of Guidant, had it been simply a project within the vascular business?
I think that the answer to that was you could, if you had the ability to provide that focus. One can always say in a large company you can create a walled off place inside the big company to do what we did in a quote walled off place in Mountain View. But I'd have to say the structure was again this opportunity to say how do we want this business to work in a manner where we do in a very singular way what we believed was the right way to solve this problem. And if one looked at our operating model within ACS, then Guidant to what we created in the creation of BVS, it was a company revolving around an iteration as the way to solve the problem. And so let me try to characterize that. In a metallic stent development program, non-DES, but metallic stent, one of the key enablements that ACS had was to go over 100 designs relatively quickly. And you could imagine that if it takes you 2 weeks to do a design, but it takes 100 to get it right, that's a long time. 200 weeks is 4 years. If you can do a design in a day, 200 times is not really that long. So our focus at BVS was how do we design everything around that philosophy? And so if you were to look at the BVS building as we set it up, the clean room in the middle, the engineers on the outside, no real conference room to sit in because if you have a conference room to sit in, you sit in the conference room. It ends up being a philosophy around everything has to revolve around turning ideas from design to implementation to test, from testing on the bench to progressing into a preclinical, and then obviously. So we actually philosophically set a program in place where the first goal was speed, even if we didn't know the answer. Because the idea was, if you're going to fail quickly, but have a system which can turn at least multiples of what most people could turn. Because then you can just range find your way to something, obviously with science happening in parallel, but range find your way into a solution as opposed to you've got, as any company might, if it takes us 6 months to do it, you've only got a few chances in a year.
In 2005, you were asked to come back to Guidant. I take it this was before the deal with the proposed takeover by Johnson & Johnson was announced. How did you find out about the takeover by Johnson & Johnson, and what did it come as a surprise to the folks at Guidant?
Oh, no. Clearly that it wasn't a situation where it was a surprise to Guidant. I think in many ways the strategic review we did, the search for the way that Guidant would maximize value for the shareholders, led us to the pathway of identifying that perhaps there was a partnership which could allow that to occur. And so it wasn't a situation where it was an aggressive takeover. It more was a situation where for the business and at that time, this was the right direction for us to take. So and obviously it wasn't a well-kept secret in the public either, so it became a fairly public discussion with J&J.
Were you surprised when Boston came into the picture? Had you anticipated that as you played out the scenario of a potential merger with Johnson & Johnson?
Well, the dynamics around what ended up being the TCT, and I think at that point when there were certain terms and conditions of our relationship with J&J where they decided that they would reevaluate those terms, I think led us to an organization as Guidant to say, okay, how are we going to go forward? Because we have multiple pathways, not the least of which would have been to stay as a separate entity and go forward, which had its challenges. So I think it was a fairly dynamic time. I think the fact that there was another company that was interested in offering value was not surprising to us because we thought as Guidant, we were a company of significant value. And the form that the relationship ended up taking with Boston and of course over the course of time with Abbott participating as part of that transaction, I'd have to say was probably not what one would have predicted, but at the at the outcome of it, and at the end of the day, I think a very good way for Guidant to have exited, if you will, from the market. It turned out to be, for both parts of our organization, and although very challenging to implement, I think a way in which we said, how can we create value, obviously for the shareholders at the moment, but also a way in which the technologies and the assets, if you will, relationships and people, that we could actually see a pathway to having this be a win-win.
So I don't know if you feel comfortable answering this, but when Ron Donis was here, he said quite frankly that when he watched, as he watched Johnson & Johnson in Boston battle it out, he was rooting for Johnson & Johnson. Did you feel the same way? And do you know how widespread that feeling was at Guidant at the time? Was that an inappropriate question to ask?
You know,
you don't work for Boston anymore.
Yeah, I'll answer
so
it this
care.
Way. I am very pleased that I became part of the Abbott organization. So, you know, I actually think in, you know, anytime two companies compete, as we did, I would say though, with Guidant, and I've used this analogy for the employees of the organization. You know, in many ways, you know, although business is business and it's much more than sports, I use the analogy of, you know, it's like you go to college. Right, and you're in college for a period of time and eventually graduate from college, and you may find yourself playing a professional sport on the other side of the 50-yard line or the half-court line from people you went to college with. That doesn't mean you have any less remembrance of what it was like to be part of that college experience, but at the moment, you know, when the whistle blows, it's competition. So now within Boston, some people I know very well are, quote, on the other side. That doesn't diminish the experience we had together, the learning we had through part of that, but you know, now we're on different sides of the equation and we compete in a manner as if we went to the same college, but now it's a new ball game. And I think that's something that I have a great deal of belief on, because I respect a lot of the people who went to Boston, but you know.
Well, particularly with your roots in the CRM business, which is what Boston wound up largely keeping. Before we're running out of time. I want to get to your move over to Abbott, but let me ask you one other question. Some of the problems that J&J was dealing with because about the J&J deal came about because of the struggles of the implantable defibrillator division, which is a division that you were intimately involved with in the 1990s. Did that have a special meaning for you? I mean, as it kind of came down to J&J's difficulties with the problems that were going on at the ICD division, although you were now in vascular, did that kind of resonate for you as you watched that play out?
Well, you know, the evolution of the cardiac rhythm management market, not just the experience that Guidant went through, and even after the transaction with Boston that Boston now and other companies are going through, is one that is sometimes I'd say difficult to watch. But I think where, you know, and I say this, you know, because I believe it, implantable defibrillators work. Are they perfect? Are they perfect? As I would say, from an electrical engineering principle, you can't build an electrical engineering device or a device built on electronics that is perfect. It's just what's the level of imperfection that we're willing to accept, and how do those levels of imperfection, when they manifest themselves, what's the impact on the patient? I think there was growing at that time a belief that implantable defibrillators were perfect, and you know, I think as any engineer would tell you can't build a perfect device. Because if you build one, it'll never come to market. It is almost by its goal, you can't get there. So I would say that having watched that unfold over the course of time, I think perhaps there has been some appropriate view that, well, maybe they're not as perfect as we thought, therefore they need to get better. And being a technologist, I have the fundamental belief that implantable defibrillators will get better because what they do is save lives. And in that context, whether it's prophylactically or in the setting of a patient who's already had sudden cardiac death, they're the right therapy for a significant number of patients. And therefore, the technology will progress and we'll perhaps see that market once again move in the right direction.
In the mid-1980s, you joined a small medical device division within a larger pharmaceutical company, a device division that would soon become a powerhouse in medical devices. When you joined Abbott in 2007 after the divestiture of the vascular business, you joined you joined a medical device business, a smaller medical device business within a large pharmaceutical company. And I think Abbott already has some claims to being a powerhouse in devices. Did it feel similar to you? Were you more struck by the similarities between between the Lilly medical device business in the 1980s and the Abbott medical device business in the 2000s? Or do the dissimilarities or the differences seem stronger to you? How much did that experience feel like you were back to what you'd been doing 20 years earlier?
Well, I would say, although there are some similarities, and you know, I think you painted perhaps those that could be seen as similar, it is 20 years later, and what we can do with medical devices today is much more advanced than what we could do 20 years ago. And you know, looking at the rate of electronics, polymer science, mechanical engineering, and then the ability to model, and we'll say this with computers, you know, model mechanical approaches, you know, it's almost mind-boggling to think of where we were 20 years ago with, you know, microprocessor technology to where we are today. So I would say, although there are similarities in terms of the companies, today where we are with technology is very different. I would also say that the approach that Abbott is taking to medical devices and the creation of a balanced portfolio or an ability to participate in pharmaceuticals and nutritionals and diagnostics and devices, you know, I think is done with a manner in which it's a recognition that these are different businesses. There's obviously always when you're part of a corporation, a common culture, a common theme. But I think Abbott has approached it very clearly that because they're different, they need to be run differently, managed differently, and managed in a way in which each group has the capability to be successful in isolation, not just because they're part of this collective total. And I actually do believe that that's a very strong difference that probably exists much more today within Abbott than did at that time within Lilly.
Abbott is about to launch Zions, and it's not too much to say it's one of the most anticipated product launches in a long time. Do you feel somewhat vindicated now that Guidant DS project is suddenly coming to fruition as you'll now have your DES to launch?
Well, I would say I won't be successful till we have market leadership. Launching the product is probably what I would call the opening bell. The true belief, and I know I'm very biased in this belief, is that you know we have an organization. And with the connection to Abbott, we have developed an organization that can lead in the market of interventional cardiology. So launching the product is clearly the first step. You know, we're building that, if you will, over the course of our international launch, which happened a year and a half ago. But it will be a momentous occasion. I would have to say that doesn't complete the circuit. It just is the start of what I think is just as if, you know, when we were Guidant, it was the multi-link. So I think Zions sets in motion for Abbott Vascular, you know, the opportunity to demonstrate that we can go from the first to multiple generations and through the course of time advance patient care. And that's exciting.
I know there's some folks, we're running out of time, I know there's some folks who've got some questions. Let me end the formal part of the interview here by noting that last August you became head of all of Abbott's medical device businesses. And I think even if everyone's here in the cardiovascular field, they must know that Abbott's got major franchises in diabetes and in spine. What's it like suddenly having to learn spine business and the diabetes business to keep to get a handle on those organizations that you now oversee?
Well, I always have enjoyed the opportunity to learn. And I think that's something I've always appreciated, you know, through the course of my career, is always being challenged to learn something, you know, whether it's a different geography, a different functional area, or in this particular case, learn about how different technologies can be applied to different problems. I would say, though, that it's, you know, it's consistent I get the question sometimes, why did I stay generally with the same company, although the company has changed its name over the course of time? I'd have to say there are three things that, and this will get more directly to answer your question, that I'm excited about, and that is, you know, having the opportunity to work on big problems with technology that, you know, as an engineer I'd say is cool. You know, that is cool. And to do it with people who share the passion about you know, what you're doing, why you're doing it, and how you're doing it. You know, those are rare things to be able to find an opportunity to always have a chance to do. So, you know, addressing diabetes, addressing spinal problems, these are things that are of value to do that I can be passionate about doing and doing it with people that are of a similar passion. So I'm very excited to be given that opportunity and to learn those businesses and understand how their similarities and differences and how, you know, we can advance that. That is very exciting.
Well, great. Well, thank you very much. This has really been outstanding. If we've got some questions from the audience, I'll take them now. Here's one over here.
Different when I'm working with a group, say at your company, trying to move a technology forward, it takes so long. And when I'm working with a company though that is independent, has some sort of other funding, they seem to move so much more quickly. Is that from an innovator standpoint, that's so frustrating because is it the vertical integration that, and the vertical hierarchies in a larger company that make it more of a challenge to really innovate rather than just sort of have this cadence of evolutionary technologies, or is it that the smaller companies are more nimble, that the horizontal hierarchy is actually a greater advantage? Is there any way to structure that? And I know this has been tried at Abbott and a number of other companies, to nest those kinds of groups within a company, yet they never seem to work quite as well as a startup does.
So the question is, just for those who didn't hear it, is, if I can paraphrase, is why is it so much more difficult to really innovate within a large hierarchical organization than a small startup? And actually, that resonates with some comments you made to me about the experience of big companies and small companies, because big companies do have much greater resources. I know it was an issue that Abbott faced when it was doing its roll-up of cardiovascular technologies. How do you preserve the virtue of that startup dynamic within a large, you know, Fortune 100 corporation?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll try to address that first with, at the end of the day, it isn't how you move it from the first square to the second or the third. It's can you get it all the way to the end, right? And having, oftentimes you can make perhaps more progress initially with smaller entities, smaller companies, because they do have that focus, that driven to one thing. I think at the end of the day, though, one says if at the end of the day you want it to have a patient impact, which is all the way through commercialization, can large companies get there just as fast, even though there's more inertia you have to overcome initially? That's why, having experienced a lot of some technologies we've acquired from startup companies, sometimes you have to go back and revisit some of the quality system approaches, some of the ways in which it got to generation one and two, because it's probably not to a point where you can make a million of them in a predictable fashion or whatever the scale needs to be. That being said, I do think that large companies can operate in a more nimble fashion. And there are structures perhaps like BVS, or there are structures where I think maybe your proposal or thought is, how do you have incubators which can incubate and develop? Still within the construct of the quality system that's later required to bring it to commercialization, but perhaps not with a lot of the process that can tend to slow things down. And I'd have to say that it's my belief that this is why I'm excited about being part of Abbott, that I think Abbott has a chance to demonstrate that large companies can do it. I think it has been perhaps the experience that large companies haven't done it. But I tend to operate with the belief that just because it hasn't been done doesn't mean it can't be done. It just requires perhaps a thinking around how do you structure, and then how do you focus on that being one of your key deliverables of success.
Another question? Let me ask one more. Oh, there's one up here. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Did everybody hear the question? Should we repeat it? Just when you were assessing technologies, how did you know which ones were going to win, which ones were going to lose?
Yeah. Well, and there's kind of a bridging function, which is in the area of intellectual property, which, you know, I'll talk about that one first, which is a lot, as I'm sure many of you can appreciate, in medical technology, revolves around your ability to not only protect what you're doing, but not be blocked from doing it when you finally get to the end of the game, which is coming to commercialization. So there is a very significant role of assessing the intellectual property. And that's not just from the, I think from a legal standpoint, it's, is the IP that you're protecting IP that's absolutely critical to enable the product to work as it's being developed or designed. I think the other part is being able to look past the problem at the moment. And I'd have to say it's trying to look through, is this a physical problem? Meaning, is it a biological problem, or is it something which eventually you're going to run into? Or is it something which is just, you know, I'd have to say more traditional engineering, which you can power your way through, you know, a mechanical, an electrical, or a material. Because I'm generally the belief that you can power your way through this, but if you're hitting a biological or a what I'd call physical problem, you just can't power your way through that. So that is a key part when you're doing early stage, you know, technology assessment. Is can you understand if there are ways this problem can be solved, but try to avoid looking at the problem that's being clinically manifested today. It's can we understand how the technology can progress? And I think the other aspect of looking at it also is what is it going to take to get there? And I think is it when you eventually get there as a technology assessment, can you see your pathway to making money in this venture? You may be eventually able to overpower all of it, but then end up with a product that can't hit the market in terms of its cost structure, or can't hit what a manufacturing person would say is, you know, a manufacturable product at volume. And I think that's another key aspect, because eventually, if you're going to go all the way through to market the product and not just, you know, somewhere in between sell it to somebody else, you're going to have to take it through commercialization and manufacturability.
Well, I would love to stay here another half hour, and I'm not certain John would, but I think we have to leave because we have a reception outside and then things to do after that. So thank you, John, very much. This was really great.
Thank you.
And thank you all. And the reception is right back there.
Great.
Do you think that went well?
Yeah.